This is The Allusionist, in which I, Helen Zaltzman, interrupt my planned episode because there's breaking news. As in news of everything being broken. This episode isn't about current events, but is somewhat inspired by them, because the specifics change, but the chaos is perennial, or so it seems. Content note, there are descriptions of torture around about halfway through. On with the show. Today, we've got three political eponyms. Ira Glass voice. Chapter 1. Cacareco. In Brazil, a voto cacareco is a slang term for a protest vote. Aptly, cacareco means a useless object or an old, worn-out thing, sometimes a trinket, but that's not what the term is referring to. It's an eponym. Although Cacareco was named after the word because of her supposed resemblance to rubbish when she was born. Look, it's just unfair to judge anyone on their appearance at birth. There's everything to play for after that. Cacareco lived most of her life in Rio de Janeiro, but it was Sao Paulo that put her into the political lexicon. In 1959, she was seconded there for a few months, and during that period, city council elections were being held. And the 3.7 million citizens at the time were very disenchanted with their corrupt politicians and the mess the city was in. Prices had been soaring, there were food shortages, the roads were a mess, sewers were overflowing. Imagine, don't need to imagine, it's happening. Despite there being a whopping 540 candidates to choose from for the 45 council seats, people decided to add one more. Cacareco became the write-in candidate of choice. The way the voting worked was that members of the electorate each had an envelope in which to put the ballot paper of their chosen candidate. That year it was quite a popular move to put a black bean in the envelope to protest the shortage of beans, albeit by further depriving oneself of a bean. But an even more popular move was to put Cacareco into the polling envelope. So popular, in fact, that Cacareco received more than 100,000 votes, winning by a landslide. The next closest candidate only got 10,079 votes, and of the 11 political parties running, even the biggest couldn't beat Cacareco with their cumulative 95,000 votes. So what's the problem? Well, Cacareco was only 5 years old, and she was a rhinoceros. Cacareco had been sent on loan by her home zoo in Rio to be the star attraction at the newly opened Sao Paulo Zoo. She was just there to eat vegetables and snooze and be looked at, you know, do rhino in a zoo stuff. Her swerve into politics was unexpected, but not unprecedented. Cacareco was not the first non-human animal candidate for public office, and certainly not the last. 4 years earlier in another Brazilian city, a goat had won an election, and it wasn't even the first goat to win an election in Brazil. In many countries, there have been creature candidates, including cats, gerbils, sheep, crawfish, chimpanzees, gorillas, turkeys, cockatoos, roosters, dogs, so many dogs, and pigs, including Pigasus, who was running for US presidency in 1968. Pigasus was arrested at a rally, and Richard Nixon went on to win that election. That's before we even get into the inanimate objects that have been electoral candidates, such as the foot powder that was elected mayor of a town in Ecuador in 1967. Animals are joke candidates, but it's not animal politicians that make politics a joke. But when human politicians are a joke, it's not the laughing kind. As Cacareco's supporters said during her campaign, better to elect a rhino than an ass. But it might be better to elect an ass than a human. A mule named Boston Curtis did win for Republicans in 1938 in Milton, Washington. It was a prank by a Democrat to prove the voters didn't care about knowing who they were voting for or what their policies were. The mule didn't even have policies, it's a mule! Despite winning the election so resoundingly, Cacareco got boaty McBoat-faced and was not allowed to take office on the Sao Paulo Council. And I've seen differing accounts for why. Like, she was not a resident of Sao Paulo. She was already back home in Rio by the time the election actually happened, possibly bundled back there as part of a coup against her political ascendancy, or possibly snatched back by Rio, peeved that another city was laying claim on Rio's special rhino. Or was Sao Paulo just bitter about this rhinoceros-shaped insult to their democratic offerings? A week after that election, Sao Paulo held another one, and a human won, if you can really consider it winning if you already know that people preferred to vote for a rhino than you. a rhino whose zookeeper described as having a brain that would fit in a Brazil nut. Kakureko continued to be added to more bills and elections, and was beaten to the student presidency of the University of Havana by the Cuban revolutionary Rolando Cubela. But in 1962, she died of a liver problem, aged only 8 years and 8.5 months young for a rhinoceros. Her legacy? She inspired the founding of the Rhinoceros Party of Canada in 1963, which for decades ran on joke policies like repealing the law of gravity and paving the province of Manitoba to make the world's biggest parking lot. And Kakureko is memorialised in Brazil's eponymous expression for a protest vote, Voto Kakureko. When the human politicians have failed so much to be appealing, you would rather vote for a rhinoceros. The rhino won't fix the sewers either, but at least she's not going to use her powers for evil. Rhinos are chaotic neutral. Chapter 2. Guy. This is a piece that was on The Allusionist a few years ago about the origins of the word guy, from Guy Fawkes. 'Tis the season, with the 5th of November Guy Fawkes night impending. And to explore the complex and fascinating history of the word and the person, I was joined by historian Victoria Buckley and longtime eponym fan Roman Mars.
Do you know anything about Guy Fawkes?
I do.
As an American?
Yes, the gunpowder plot. I know at least the edges of that story as somewhat reinforced by, I'm sure, completely historically accurate V for Vendetta. Yeah, I know who Guy Fawkes is. I know what a Guy Fawkes mask is. I had no idea that Guy Fawkes predated the use of the word guy as a general person.
No, I didn't either. When you grow up in Britain, you don't know a lot more than you do as an American who had V for Vendetta. What you know is that on the 5th of November, there are fireworks displays everywhere. And in some places, they'll still have a bonfire and they'll burn a guy on it, which is an effigy of a human named after Guy Fawkes, who, in the early hours of the 5th of November 1605, was arrested for the gunpowder plot to blow up the Houses of Parliament.
Wow.
So this general word for person that we have now came from an effigy, which came from a specific person.
That's amazing. That's amazing.
Get ready for a concentrated dose of 16th and early 17th century English history.
It was Henry VIII, basically, who wanted to get together with Anne Boleyn. At that point, England was entirely Catholic. And Henry VIII wrote to the Pope and said, I want to get divorced. I want to get together with Anne Boleyn. And the Pope went, absolutely no way, that's not happening. And Henry VIII went, well, I'll just start my own church then.
That's the historian Dr. Victoria Buckley. And that church King Henry VIII started was the Church of England, which retained some of his favourite bits of Catholicism, but allowed him to get out of his first of six marriages. This was known as the Reformation, and in 1534, England officially separated from Rome. Bye, Pope! Hello, centuries of religious and political turmoil.
What happened was that England then became a country that was kind of divided between those people who subscribed to the new Protestant faith and Catholics who adhered to the old way of doing things.
Monasteries and convents, of which there are about 900 around England, were dissolved, their property and money seized, their religious artefacts destroyed. Catholic practices like confession and praying to the Virgin Mary were banned. The pendulum oscillated during the reigns of Henry VIII's children, veering more Protestant under Edward VI, back to Catholic under Mary, then away again under Elizabeth I, who couldn't endorse Catholicism because, by its tenets, she was Henry's illegitimate child as the product of his controversial second marriage, and therefore could not be a legitimate monarch.
And under Elizabeth I, she was essentially a Protestant queen, but she had maintained a lot of Catholic ideas.
She wasn't sympathetic to Catholics, though. Very soon after she took to the throne, a law was passed making it compulsory to attend Church of England services. Under threat of fines, imprisonment, or execution, Catholics had to worship in secret. After a 44-year reign, Queen Elizabeth died in 1603, and King James VI of Scotland travelled south to become King James I of England.
There was a lot of disgruntlement because he was a very, very, very staunch Protestant.
The gunpowder plotters certainly weren't pleased. They wanted a Catholic monarch, or at least a monarch who was tolerant of Catholicism. Add that to the clutch of reasons that have been offered for their plot.
Part of it, I think, was the idea of notoriety. Part of it was the idea of making a big splash. They were quite interested in just political change for its own sake, and they also were a bit disgruntled. But above and beyond that, they wanted to restore the Catholic religion. They wanted to get rid of James I. And if their plot had been successful, they would have blown up the Houses of Parliament, which means they would have blown up the king. They would have wiped out the judiciary, the clergy. It would have effectively sort of decapitated the head of the ruling body in England.
The gunpowder plot started being plotted around the end of 1603, start of 1604, by a man in his early 30s named Robert Catesby. Several members of his Catholic family had been imprisoned or fined for their faith. First, he recruited his cousin, Thomas Wintour, and then John Wright and his brother-in-law, Thomas Percy.
And then they realised that they were going to need quite a lot of other people in the group. So they dispatched someone overseas to the Netherlands, where England was at war with Spain. And that's where they met Guy Fawkes.
Guy Fawkes was English, but as a Catholic, he had been fighting on the side of the Spanish for the previous 10 years.
He was a really, really, really well-respected captain, and he was very devout. But he was known as an ordnance man, so his expertise was in laying wires for gunpowder and stuff like that.
In the end, there were 13 plotters altogether. Several of them had been involved, along with Catesby, in the thwarted 1601 Essex Rebellion against Queen Elizabeth. Back in London, in March 1605, they rented a vault beneath the Houses of Parliament and hid 36 barrels of gunpowder in it. They planned to detonate on the day of the state opening of Parliament, which was set for the 5th of November 1605. But then,
What was known as the Montagu letter was sent in October of 1605. Lord Montagu was a famous Catholic, and someone tipped him off. It basically said, don't go to Parliament on the 5th of November because you'll be blown to smithereens.
Nobody's sure who wrote that letter to Lord Montagu, but King James I sent people to search for signs of trouble. On the night of the 4th of November 1605, the eve of the planned plot, Guy Fawkes went to the vault to check on the gunpowder to make sure everything was ready to detonate the next day. Unfortunately for him, the keeper of the precinct of Westminster was poking around beneath Parliament.
And he went into the vault, and there, of course, he found Guy Fawkes clutching a lantern and a box of matches, or a tinder box.
In the early hours of 5th of November, Guy Fawkes was arrested and imprisoned in the Tower of London.
Then, on the 7th of November, Guy Fawkes was tortured in the Tower. He was manacled, which involved his hands being put into iron manacles and then suspended from the stone wall. And underneath his feet was like a pile of firewood. And then very gradually they kicked bits of the firewood away. So he was effectively suspended by his wrists. So his wrists were both broken. And then they racked him on the rack. All his joints were effectively completely dislocated or broken because he'd been so badly tortured. He started naming loads of names and spilling the beans.
While Guy Fawkes was being tortured in the Tower of London, what about the other plotters? They were already nowhere near. When word got around about the Montagu letter, they had fled London and were hiding 130 miles away.
They all holed themselves up in this house called Holbeach House in Staffordshire. And they were all lying around going, phew, you know, narrow escape. And they were drying some gunpowder by the fire. And it exploded in a really ironical way. A lot of them went, oh, God, that's, you know, divine intervention. And they all fled from Holbeach House. But the authorities caught up with them. And there was a huge siege. A lot of the plotters then were killed in this siege. They were shot in this siege.
The surviving plotters were taken to the Tower of London. And at the end of January 1606, they and Guy Fawkes were publicly executed.
They met the most awful end. They were hung, drawn and quartered, which effectively meant being hung by the neck until you were almost dead, but not actually dead. Then you were cut down. Then all your organs were cut out and they were set fire to before your eyes. and you were eventually dispatched on a butcher's block. That was the penalty for treason. But that served as a not only horrendous punishment, obviously, but it also served to deter people who were thinking, well, maybe I'll commit a bit of treason against the king, or maybe I'll, you know, get involved in a plot. It was because executions in that period were huge spectacles, a bit like theatre. People went along to have a good look at what was happening and to watch people going through all of this awful, slow, butcherous method of being killed. And it was public theatre.
And it soon became a public celebration as well. A couple of months after the foiled plot, an Act of Parliament was passed that actually made it law to celebrate Gunpowder Treason Day every 5th of November to give thanks for the joyful deliverance of James I from the Catholic plotters. And even though that law was repealed in 1859, towns and villages all over England still mark the 5th of November each year with fireworks and a bonfire. Why a bonfire?
Well, bonfire was part of the Protestant tradition, so people would light bonfires in the street in order to celebrate things. For example, when James I came to the throne, people lit bonfires, and it became a standard practice to celebrate in the street with fires and stuff like that.
And in the aftermath of the Gunpowder Plot, anti-Catholic sentiment was even more virulent than it had been before, so people would chuck onto the bonfires effigies of the Pope or the Devil, and then, in time, of Guy Fawkes.
In the 18th century, Guy Fawkes started to become synonymous with bonfire.
In the run-up to Bonfire Night, children would wheel around their Guy Fawkeses, asking for money. Penny for the guy! Eventually, the Bonfire Night effigies came to be of other hate figures as well. The town of Lewes in East Sussex keeps up the tradition each year at its particularly enthusiastic Bonfire Night events with a topical choice, such as, in 2015, the then Prime Minister of Britain, David Cameron, with a pig's head. Google it. But somehow, Guy Fawkes's name is the one that became attached to the effigies. By the early 19th century, they were known as Guys. And then by the 1830s, the word guy meant a scruffily dressed person, either in reference to the state of the effigies, or of the people who were begging with them. By 1847, guy was an informal term for a male person in American English. So somehow the word crossed the Atlantic and took on a new meaning, forgetting the connection to a political plot more than two centuries before.
Oh, that's interesting.
You innovated.
Yeah.
You took that meaning out and you gave that word to everyone. Treating you as a representative of your nation.
Well, thank you. that is remarkable.
But is it fair that out of the 13 gunpowder plotters, Guy Fawkes is the one who is remembered in this way?
No, not at all. Because the poor man, really, I mean, he wasn't the ringleader. He was only brought in to do the ordnance stuff. He was just a very small cog. But because he was the only one that was initially captured, he's the one that's now representative of the whole thing. So he is now the big bad bogeyman. And that's been consistent since 1605. But it's only because all the others fled the scene and left him to carry the can, effectively. The real person that we all really ought to be thinking of as being the person that's ultimately representative of the plot is Robert Catesby. I mean, he was the mastermind. He was the one who dreamt it all up. He was the one that raised all the money, found all the ammo and organised everything and found the vault and sent people overseas to agitate in the Netherlands. I mean, he really was the ringleader, whereas Guy Fawkes was just a bit of a beard that happened to be caught with his matches in his pocket.
This eponym, though, I'm wondering whether it partly caught on because it's such a small word, three letters, and it's basically a consonant and a breath. And
yeah,
therefore it's easy to assimilate and it's easy to use often. So I'm wondering whether some aesthetic of the word made it common, because it could have been so different. Guy Fawkes didn't go by the name Guy Fawkes. It was his birth name. Mm-hmm. But the name he went by was John Johnson. And John's
yeah
isn't such a general term for people. It means something specific.
Yeah, it does. Although it's, yeah, it is, yeah, it is more specific. That's interesting.
I guess it is another gentleman term.
It's a family show.
And then he styled himself Guido. That was a more Spanish version mm-hmm. of Guy. And he'd been fighting on behalf of the Spanish for the best part of a decade.
Yeah, we could say a bunch of Guidos, essentially.
Yes, but that term has a meaning as well, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. I would say that it would probably be the slightly derogatory epithet for a group of Italian Americans or something like that. You'd call them Guidos or something.
I wouldn't, but I've only heard that term in the context of people commentating upon Jersey Shore, which I have never seen.
Yeah, I mean, that's my sense of it. But I've never seen it or probably heard it used beyond what was on television. So,
and then we could have had Robert Catesby's or Roberts.
Yeah, Catesby's would never. I think you're right in the sense that the shortness as a phoneme Guy is really satisfying. Catesby's or Roberts wouldn't work. Guido's wouldn't work exactly. But I still find it kind of amazing that you would have the idea of this effigy becoming a general term. It's weird that an enemy of the state that is burned in effigy would take on such an anodyne moniker, that the evil of that wouldn't transfer. It's like calling people, like a group of people, a bunch of Hitlers. Hey, Hitlers, how's it going?
Hey, Osamas.
Exactly. Exactly. Because you just can't picture it with any other terrorist. So to have any of the morality sort of leached away from it is kind of stunning. You'd think that would be the thing that would be retained in the meaning, is the plot.
Or of the divisive history wrapped up in it. Because on the one hand, you have people who call Guy Fawkes a terrorist, a Catholic terrorist, while on the other, you have him being the unfortunate figurehead of an attempt to agitate politically on behalf of the oppressed Catholics.
If the meaning wasn't, you know, transferred for this long and lost at a certain point, then you just have to let it go. Because everything has horrible origins.
Yeah, a lot of words in our language have, in a metaphorical sense, a man lurking beneath them with a load of gunpowder and some matches.
Exactly.
We've got one more political eponym to go. Coming up next, Bork. This show is such an education for me. Until I looked it up yesterday on one of my daily etymological strolls, I did not know that Bork was an eponym. Maybe not in all its uses, like the doggo-lingo wry respelling of bark, or in the mouth of the Muppet Swedish chef, where it's a gibberish word. Usage like computers borked is probably a deliberate misspelling of broken, but it may have come from the eponym from Robert Bork, the American judge twice thwarted from being appointed to the Supreme Court. Quite a lot of political eponyms are fairly straightforwardly the labels of an ideology, like Maoism or Leninism or Blairism or McCarthyism. But a lot that have come up quite a bit on the show before were more oblique and often disses, like silhouette, chauvinism, quisling and gerrymander. It's so often not the legacy the eponymous person might have wanted, but they rarely get the choice. Trying to get language to do what you want is like trying to get a cat to take medicine. I'd heard of the term Bork, but I hadn't heard of Robert Bork, just like I hadn't heard of Russian politician Vyacheslav Molotov, after whom Molotov cocktails were named, in a bit of satirical eponymy by the Finns during the Soviet-Finnish War of 1939. Molotov was the Soviet foreign minister at the time, second in command to Joseph Stalin, and Molotov's breadbaskets was the Finnish nickname for the cluster bombs being dropped on them, so-called because supposedly Molotov had said on state radio that these were not bombs but food aid packages being airdropped in. This bit of propaganda might itself have been propaganda, but since the Finns were the ones getting things dropped on them, they got license with the jokey name, and they also extended it to the improvised incendiary projectiles they were lobbing at Soviet tanks, the Molotov cocktails, a drink to go with the bread. They're officially called things like bottle bombs or burning bottles, more descriptive, but it's so often the case that eponyms stick, even though all they tell you on the surface of it is that a person has been invoked. And so, to Bork. Merriam-Webster defines it as to attack or defeat a nominee or candidate for political office unfairly through an organised campaign of harsh public criticism or vilification. It's not so far away from the computer type of Bork. Both suggest brokenness beyond repair. Borkenness beyond repair. Like Robert Bork's chances of getting appointed to the Supreme Court. In 1973, Robert Bork had had a sniff of that Supreme Court seat, not literally, as far as I know, I'm not trying to imply anything. The then President Richard Nixon had promised him the next available place on the Supreme Court as a reward. Nixon had wanted Watergate Special Prosecutor Archibald Cox to be fired, and the Attorney General and the Deputy Attorney General had refused to do it and resigned in protest. Who's next in line to sack Archibald Cox? Solicitor General Robert Bork. And he did do it. He fired that man. But then Bork didn't get his reward of the next Supreme Court seat because before one became available, Nixon's presidency was borked, in the computer sense. And when a seat did open up in 1975 during Gerald Ford's presidency, civil rights groups protested against Bork being nominated, given his record of, for instance, in 1964, opposing a law to require restaurants and hotels to serve customers of all races, or in 1965, opposing the abolition of a ban on contraceptives for married couples. Bork was a staunch originalist, meaning if something wasn't enshrined in the Constitution, original version not updated, Bork wasn't a fan of it. That included the right to privacy, feminism, sexual revolution. So Ford decided not to nominate him for Supreme Court. Did consider making him director of the CIA, but decided he was too unpopular for that too. Bork went back to teaching law and being a judge. Then in 1987, that Supreme Court seat came within sitting distance again when Bork was added to the list of potential nominees for Ronald Reagan to consider. Joe Biden had been amenable to Bork's possible nomination when it was mooted a year earlier, but now told Reagan, if you nominate him, you'll have trouble on your hands. And turned out to be right. Reagan did nominate Bork, and the eponymous Borking started. Almost immediately, in fact, a mere 45 minutes after Bork's nomination, Senator Ted Kennedy made a televised speech which included the statement,
Robert Bork's America is a land in which women would be forced into back alley abortions, blacks would sit at segregated lunch counters, rogue police could break down citizens' doors in midnight raids, and school children could not be taught about evolution. Writers and artists would be censured at the whim of government.
In the political climate of 2022, this would not balk Bork at all. It would probably work in his favour. But back then, Bork did say there was not a line in that speech that was accurate. I am not the one who will pick through the debris of Bork's voting records to determine what his political preferences really were in practice, how what he did aligned with what he said. But wherever there is uncertainty, wherever there is contradiction, there is the opportunity for any side to stick in a crowbar and crank it wide open to let a whole load more in. Civil rights groups and left-wingers could say that Bork was in favour of segregation and anti-contraception, and the right wing could say that's a lie. Bork could say that the opinions he had espoused in the past wouldn't affect his choices as a Supreme Court judge, but nobody could know whether or not that would turn out to be true. A partisan brawl waged for weeks. Bork's nomination gave the Republicans an opportunity to get more conservative lawmaking, and the Democrats fought to prevent it. A particular concern for the left was that Bork would overturn Roe v. Wade, and that's one point that the right agreed with, he probably would. But Bork... well, Bork did not get that seat on the Supreme Court. The Senate vote on him was the third worst defeat on record. And people said that Bork had been borked by disinformation, propaganda, false claims of racist, sexist principles. But Bork may have been borked by Bork, by the dour way he represented himself and his originalist views during the 12 days of confirmation hearings, presided over by Joe Biden, who ended his own presidential campaign partway through them. Another thing borked. The term Bork took off before the hearings even happened, and 15 years later was added to the Oxford English Dictionary. As we know, language is not neutral, and the Robert Bork-derived meaning of Bork was popularised by Republicans, so it carried the sense of unfairness, a smear campaign. Bork's another word that gets used to discredit criticism, even if warranted. So although Bork has two different origins, both of them eventually come to mean destruction. It's just the eponym one comes with purposeful malevolence. Whereas computers don't care. Computers only have the power we give them. Although that does go for humans too. The Illusionist is an independent podcast pumping out that free edutainment. And if you'd like to support this endeavour, please recommend the show to somebody. I'd be very grateful. If you have some spare cash, you can also help fund the show. Go to theillusionist.org/donate, and in return, you get behind-the-scenes info about the making of each episode, you get regular live streams where I read relaxingly from one of my many dictionaries, and we chat about all sorts of topics, like butter sculpture, leaf peeping, the etymology of plankton, and wolves made of chocolate. And you get to hang out in the Illusiverse Discord community, which is a lovely, friendly corner of the internet, and aren't those precious these days? Join us at theillusionist.org/donate. Your randomly selected word from the dictionary today is kype, noun, a hook formed on the lower jaw of adult male salmon and trout during the breeding season. Try using kype in an email today. This episode was produced by me, Helen Zaltzman, thanks to Julia Falan and Caetano Gallindo, and to Martin Austwick for the music. Hear his compositions via palebirdmusic.com and on Bandcamp. Our ad partner is Multitude. To sponsor an episode of the show in 2023, contact them at multitude.productions/ads. Find me at Illusionist Show on Twitter, Facebook and Instagram, and find every episode of the podcast in audio and transcript form, and the full dictionary entries for the randomly selected words, and links to the guests, plus more information about the episode topics, all at the show's forever home, theillusionist.org.